Addiction is a major problem in the UK. For example, in the first 9 months of 2020, deaths from alcohol hit record levels in England and Wales, 5,460, a 16.4% increase on the same period in 2019. In July 2020, a House of Lords report titled Gambling Harm, Time for Action, found that half of adults in the UK gamble at least once a month. A third of a million UK citizens are problem or disordered gamblers. It's estimated that for every problem gambler, six other people are harmed by the breakup of families, crime, losing jobs, losing homes, or a death. That's a snapshot of the issue. Behind every number, there is a personal struggle, torment, and possibly an individual crisis. In the first of our Mental Health Awareness Week episodes, we're going to be looking at addiction and also looking at how individuals can help themselves. We're joined today by two men who know firsthand what it can be like. First, we have Russell Pearce, a former Welsh boxing champion whose life was taken over by an alcohol addiction, but he now helps recovering alcoholics with charity Kaleidoscope. Hello, Russ. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We also have a former guest on this podcast, ex-cricketer Patrick Foster, who battled for years with a gambling addiction. He is now Director of Educational Programs at Epic Risk Management and is also an ambassador for our charity partners, the Mintridge Foundation. Hello, Patrick. Welcome back to the podcast. And of course, my podcasting partner in crime, Will Moulton, is also here for the show today. So before we kind of dive into the heart of the issue and what can be done, I thought we would start off by essentially sharing both of your own individual stories and your own experiences with addiction. So Russ, shall we start with you? A really promising boxing career, national champion. When did the alcohol start to sort of come into your life and then become something that took over your life?
I started boxing when I was sort of 6 years old, just a bit of a hyperactive child and stuff. And I ended up being pretty good at it. Boxed, like you said, national level, won a few Welsh titles, British titles. And then kind of the age of 16, the sort of usual family stuff happens, falling out with parents, falling out with dad. And the place I felt comfortable was kind of at the pub. So I'd go there finished school at 16 and went to work, and I'd go straight to the pub sort of after work to not go home and spend time in my family home. And then I turned professional, I think I was about 18. And it's one of those things, you got paid quite good money. And it was just one of those things that I struggled to always deal with my problems, whether it be money problems, family problems, relationship problems. And I think the seed was kind of set really from my younger years, where I'd use alcohol to get away from things. And then my kind of career, I think it was about my third fight I lost in the professionals, and I still got paid the same money. And then something in my brain clicked that I don't really have to try to get paid quite a bit of money. So my drinking kind of got hold of me then. I'd turn up to fights with no training, not really caring whether I won or lost. And it was altogether that payday to carry on drinking. And then obviously you carry on losing, carry on not training, things that people are going to lose interest. And then at the end of it, I was just kind of left drinking like bottles of vodka every day in kind of a little dirty flat. I was just sleeping on my sofa, and yeah, there's bills coming through the door, just ignoring them again. And it just got to a pretty dire place really, from the highs of representing your country and things like that to being stuck in a sort of one bedroom flat on the sofa. It was a bit of a crazy time, really.
You mentioned there about how boxing sort of, you stopped doing the boxing for almost enjoyment reasons, and you were doing it just for the pay packet, I guess. Was there a moment, like, did you realize early on that this was becoming an issue, the fact that you weren't boxing because you were enjoying it and you were good at it, or and you were doing it just for the money to get the alcohol, or did that sort of not really register with you at the time that was happening?
I kind of fell out of love with boxing kind of around 16. But obviously, because I was quite good at it and I was a bit work shy at that age, I thought, oh, this is kind of an easy way to make money. But at that time when I was getting paid, and I'd go out and just spend all my money on alcohol, going to the pub, paying for friends' drinks, I just kind of thought I was a regular lad who likes going out with his mates, whereas I didn't really realise I'd be drinking kind of 3 or 4 pints to their one. But it didn't register with me for a long time that I needed to sort myself out with kind of drinking and things like that. It wasn't kind of till I was in that flat on my own and I've got a daughter, I wasn't seeing my daughter, I'd make excuses not to pick her up from school. And yeah, from someone who was always quite proud of his career to throwing it away, it's quite hard to look back on now, actually. Now I'm kind of 34 and I'm past it in terms of boxing, but that's something just I have to deal with. But it was definitely tough falling out of love with it, really.
Definitely. And what was it about the pub more so that made you feel comfortable? Was it almost that sense of belonging?
I think from the times where I wasn't really going home and didn't really have, I did have, obviously have family, but they didn't really associate with me because of my behaviour. I think it was one of those things, like I said, I'd buy drinks from friends who kind of disappeared when things got bad. But I'd always managed to find someone in the pub to kind of socialize with, whether it be kind of someone my age or someone a lot older, it wouldn't really matter to me as long as it had some reason to stay in the pub rather than go home to whatever was keeping me away from being at home.
Were there people who were noticing that maybe you were drinking more than others, or that you were sort of staying out drinking and not going home? And did anyone sort of try to intervene, or was there just not sort of the education and the awareness of the fact that you might have been struggling?
I think I speak to kind of my old manager now, and he said that he knew. And towards the end of my career, he'd kind of get my wages, as I call it, from the fight and give me so much over time, so I didn't have a big lump sum in my pocket. And my ex-partner, like my daughter's mum, knew. She always tried to get me to seek help and things like that. But I think it's one of those, I didn't really kind of know anything about addiction and things like that when I was that age. And I think with me, it was hard to see my pattern of drinking as a problem. I just thought I was someone who enjoyed going out drinking and being sociable. When I look back now, the way I was drinking, I wasn't sociable. I was a bit of an ass most of the time. I never really saw it. If someone had asked me to get help, I wouldn't know where to go for it, really.
And in terms of that turning point, and I think it was a run-in with the police and shoplifting that kind of sparked that. Is that when everything kind of fell into place in your own mind, that something was seriously wrong here and it needed to be sorted out?
When I was in that flat, I was obviously not working, didn't have any money. So I'd go to my local shop and I'd just take alcohol and just walk out. And I did get caught a few times, but because they're my local shop, they kind of said, if you come back and pay what you took tomorrow, we won't take any further. And that went on a couple of times. And then they just didn't in the end. They got fed up with it. And and called the police. And it was when I was kind of sat in a cell and sort of hangover kicking in, and I was just fed up with it then. And I'd kind of had run-ins with the police from being like antisocial behavior and things like that. And but yeah, I don't know what it was, that one time where I got arrested, and I'd sort of just had enough and just mentally, physically just drained and tired from it all, just never making ends meet. And yeah, I just had enough of it.
You say that you'd had enough, but a previous answer you sort of said you didn't really know where to go or what to do to get help. So sort of how did you get on that path to finding the help that you needed?
So when I was in the cell in the police station, a member of Kaleidoscope, who I work for now, they come they used to well we used to in a few years ago come to the people in the cells who were there for alcohol or drug related reasons and ask them if they want help. And I'd been in the cells before, and I just no I don't no I'm fine. But this time I just accepted it, and they gave me an appointment, and I just went along to it just to see what it was all about, because I didn't understand what they did. Whether some I didn't think me telling someone why I'm sad would help me, but yeah, it changed my life really.
What was it about that particular meeting that you had that you went to that just seemed to work for you?
Just people listening to me and not judging me. I always felt kind of, from a sports background, everyone knew me as the boxer who is world champion and stuff, and I always felt quite judged where I'm from the boxer who kind of could have done lots of things to the local drunk, if you like. But yeah, just the people who'd sit down and listen to me, and they don't just yeah, it's quite surreal, really.
How did it feel speaking about that potentially for the first time?
I always describe it as kind of, when you need to yawn or catch your breath, and you just finally get that big breath and you can breathe out. That's kind of what it felt like the just yeah, the weight being taken off, and it's like, oh, right, I can do something now, rather than just all the anxiety and things like that building inside. It just felt like it had all been taken away out of my hands, and someone else was dealing with it. Is yeah.
Yeah, and very much that release type thing.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like I always compare. It feels like when I really needed a drink, that first sip of drink, and then right, I'm okay now. I've had a drink, and talking about what was going on for me was the same kind of feeling. Yeah.
Definitely. We'll bring in Patrick now as well. And Patrick's own individual story, because there's probably, I suppose, listening to what Russ has said, you can probably identify a couple of similarities with your own story. Do you want to just take us through sort of your relationship with gambling and essentially how it started, but then again, how it became this thing that ultimately ruled your life for quite a period of time?
Unlike quite a lot of people now, young people possibly, gambling wasn't really part of my life at all, until I was 19 years old. My first bet was at university. At the time I went to university, I was contracted by Northamptonshire County Cricket Club. I was in the second year of my contract. I was able to combine the both. I'd had a sort of incredible upbringing. I've been very fortunate in kind of education. And I got introduced to gambling at university, as a lot of people do, as a bit of fun, something that people sort of spend their Saturdays doing. As somebody who was kind of interested in sport, very competitive, you could say that it was a kind of match made in heaven, but actually it didn't turn out to be that way at all. So I started at university. It started as a bit of fun. I was in a fortunate position. I had a bit more money than most people because I was getting paid to play cricket. I always thought, well, I can do what I want with my money. It's certainly not a problem. And then I went back to Northamptonshire at the end of my first year at university. And unfortunately, my second year of my contract didn't go so well. I was gambling at the time, but not to great excess, but it was very much a kind of distraction. And then unfortunately, on the back of a kind of disappointing year, I got released, my contract didn't get renewed. And actually that moment was really difficult. It hit me hard. I always say it was the first time that I'd ever been told I wasn't good enough at something. But actually the worst part of it was my dream was over. All I'd ever wanted was suddenly gone. And I felt like I was to blame for it. And of course, when you have those moments in life, you never really know how you're going to deal with them. And I found it really difficult, but I didn't want to let on. And actually what I found very quickly was gambling was the only thing that I found or did that provided me with a kind of substitute for that feeling of playing. And so I started to do it more. It was also a kind of form of escapism from the fact that I was feeling so bad about what had happened. I was so disappointed, but again, didn't really think it was a problem. Got through university, was able to get my degree, do all the things that students do. Nobody was aware of what was going on or the extent of it. And I then moved into the city. I got a job in insurance. I worked in the City of London in finance and everything that came with that, including sort of significant amounts of money, but being around it as well. And I just started to do it more and more and became sort of at that point obsessed with it. And then in 2010, I had a huge win. I won £35,000 from a football accumulator. And of course, that moment was life-changing because it changed my relationship with it. Because at that point, I thought I was invincible. And I thought it doesn't matter, it'll happen again. I never told anybody that it happened. I lost that money in a matter of weeks. And of course, what came with losing that money was a desire to have it back, but also a feeling of sort of stupidity, being very ashamed, embarrassed. And then when I started to lose, I started to cope in other ways. I started to drink a lot. And some of what Russell said there resonated with me on that front. And gambling started to take over my life. I made a change at that point about 6 months later because I knew something had to give. I knew I was getting myself into a mess. And that was mainly because of what it was doing to me financially. I'd never really appreciated the impact it had on me mentally. I always thought about money. And I made a change, drastic change in terms of my career. I went into teaching because I thought that would get rid of the problem. And I always thought, do you know what? I can stop at any point. But actually, as I found out the hard way, I couldn't as much as I wanted to towards the end. When I went into teaching, I then found that transition difficult. I didn't have access to the same amounts of money and things sort of started to spiral out of control. It started to affect me emotionally, financially, of course, but also professionally because I couldn't do my job properly. And I made decisions at work that I'd regret forever because I started to compromise my position as a teacher by borrowing money off people connected to the school, which I'm not proud of. I knew at some point I'd get found out, but until that point happened, I was going to keep doing it. And then a number of years later, having transacted just shy of £2 million worth of bets online, having 23 different bank and payday loans, 76 different online accounts, and an awful lot of damage that came with it, I did get found out. I panicked because I knew that my biggest secret was coming out and I couldn't cope with the fact that the world was going to find out about all these things that I was doing, the situation that I was in. I actually saw no way out other than to try and gamble my way out of the problem. And I tried and that failed. And at that point, my world came crashing down because I was left with nothing. And as Russell just said, I'd had enough. I was exhausted. The only way I saw out was actually to do the unthinkable and to try and kill myself. And I did on a couple of occasions. I came very close. Fortunately, before throwing myself in front of a moving train in March 2018, I reached out to my brother. And people always ask me, sort of, why did you reach out? And the only reason I reached out was actually because I felt like I needed to tell somebody. I felt that it was important that someone knew where I'd gone, for no other reason, because I didn't see a way out. Otherwise, I think I would have done it sooner, or I would have reached out sooner. But I did it at that moment. Unfortunately, he persuaded me not to do it, and I made the best decision I've ever made in not. And at that point, was able to seek the help that I desperately needed. It was the first time in probably 10 years that I'd been honest. I came clean. I told my family and people around me what had happened. And as Russell alluded to there, the overwhelming sense of relief that I had at that moment was like nothing you can ever describe or put into words, despite all the damage that was done. It was the first time I felt good and I felt myself. Unfortunately, I was able to then get the support that I needed. I went through treatment, through rehab, and managed to kind of piece my life back together, try and have a better understanding of why I was doing it, what had driven me to it. Talking and opening up was the key for me. Have been in recovery since, and life's a lot better without it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a story that obviously Alistair and I have heard before, but it doesn't get any less diluted that the more you hear it. It's two very sort of incredible stories there to listen to. And something you mentioned in there, Patrick, and I know sort of Russell mentioned it a bit as well, is about wanting to stop but not being able to stop. I guess that there comes a point where you do have to stop, but how difficult is that, because it's been something that you've been unable to do for so long, to actually give up the drink or to give up the gambling? Like, how difficult is that sort of physically and mentally and emotionally?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my experience, incredibly difficult, because if it was just a case of just stopping, I think I would have done it. Certainly for a number of years, I didn't want to stop because I kind of loved what I was doing and what came with it. And I always assumed that at the point where I needed to or wanted to stop, I just would. But actually, when that point came, I realized I couldn't. And actually, in the latter days, I always say to people, it was so strange because I knew I shouldn't be doing the things that I was doing. I really didn't want to do it, but I just could not stop myself. And I felt totally helpless. And that was really difficult. The addiction had taken such a strong hold of me. And it was, for me, I needed something to happen that was kind of really bad in my eyes. And I knew that at some point I would get found out, and this secret that I was harboring for so long was going to be sort of out there. And that moment came, and unfortunately that moment came when it was pretty serious, because I didn't know as such, but the results were fairly inevitable. I was going to lose my house, I was going to lose my job, and at the time in my mind I thought I'd go to prison. And that was as bad as it got for me, and that moment where I didn't want to be here anymore, it was tough. But that rock bottom was what I needed to hit. That's not always the case for everybody, I don't think, but often it takes something of significance. Russell alluded to the fact that he got in trouble with the police. For some people, it's a relationship breakdown or losing something that makes you do it. I just wish I'd done something about it sooner, but it wasn't that easy. And if it had been, or if it was, I'd like to think I would have done. But for me, it was those things, really.
The moment you reached out to your brother as well, is always, I mean, that's always stuck with me, is when we first heard it, because it is such a pivotal moment and such a key emotional moment as well in the whole story. And I suppose it ultimately emphasizes the importance of having someone to share that turmoil with. In Russ's case, whether it's someone you're speaking to at Kaleidoscope, or in your case, your brother, and then the rest of your family. Was that part of the key as well, that once the secret was out, that's it, that it's out there, and it's sort of not as much of a weight on your shoulders as it was before?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. That was obviously the turning point. It was the biggest step for me, the hardest one. But once it was made, everything after that was a lot easier. I think there's a lot of talk at the moment around kind of mental health and addiction, and people always say and speak about the need for speaking up and telling someone. But actually, sometimes it's not that easy, because if it was, people would do it sooner and more often. Some people just find it very, very difficult. And I was that person. Suicide is obviously a very sensitive topic. It's a difficult issue. And in that moment, it didn't feel selfish at all. It felt selfless. I honestly thought, well, the world's going to be a better place without me in it. And my desire to tell my brother was almost like, I need to tell him just so somebody's aware. But of course, actually, when I did that, it meant that somebody knew and someone could do something about it. And I think that was the biggest sort of turning point for me, was I had nowhere to hide any longer, because someone was aware. And that's why talking to someone is kind of so important. And who that is, it really doesn't matter. For me, it was my brother, and there were various different reasons for that. But yeah, it really doesn't matter who it is, whether it's somebody from an independent organization like Russell, or whether it's someone who's as close to you as your brother. It's a question of just telling somebody. That's the most important thing, I think. And people's reaction is so different to what you think it's going to be. And in my mind, I'd played it over and over again in my head how that moment was going to go. And it was very different to what I ever envisaged.
And Russ, I imagine hearing that, there's probably a lot of, again, similarities you can find with Patrick's story, with your own story too.
Yeah, definitely. Like the reaching out and speaking to someone, which is, I wouldn't say it was forced upon me because I was arrested, but I always find that really difficult. I think especially in sport, and boxing in particular, where it's kind of not hard, man, but you know, it's one of those things where people don't want to talk out about it. And in my role now, kind of helping others, it's, I'm always kind of front of house when people first come into service with us, and I'm usually the first person they meet. And it is quite horrible seeing how worried people are coming in. So I always, like, from being there myself, I always try to make it as friendly as possible. But it's so hard, because I find this with alcohol and gambling, really, you can take the gambling and the alcohol and the drugs away, but then you're still kind of left with yourself, which is where you need other people around you to help you through that. Makes a lot of sense what you're saying, yeah.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
Mental Health Awareness Week is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. You can find more information and support it at www.mentalhealth.org.uk.
Do you find from your experiences, maybe not your own personal ones, but from people you know, that the people that are around those who are suffering sometimes find it a bit difficult as well, because they don't want to say the wrong thing or don't want to do the wrong thing? Or is it just sort of a natural, do they just have that natural instinct to just want to protect them, and actually it's quite an easy thing to rally around someone when they've admitted that they're struggling?
Yeah, it's both. You see kind of both ends of it, really. You get family members who kind of tread on eggshells, where and those who just kind of kick into maybe parental kind of responsibility, where they just nurture them, and you see all kinds of different support, really. But I've found with my family, we've got a real close relationship now since I kind of admitted the things I've done wrong, and It is just one of those. We've had family kind of meetings when I went to rehab. I sort of sent away a survey to them to express how they feel about my using and things like that. And they were really honest with me and how it made them feel. And I found that that really helped me. And because I think when you're in the addiction, you're the only kind of person who matters. And like especially for me, everyone else in the firing line didn't really matter. As long as I kind of got through my day and was able to get through it with alcohol or whatever, that was the main thing for me. And yeah, family members, I think it's a real struggle for family members. We see it a lot at work, where they'll ring up and ask, can we help the family members through it and things, and because they don't know what to say and don't know what to do. And I think it's really difficult for them.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think one of the hardest things is that, certainly in my experience and what I've seen subsequently, is that actually I look back and I wish I'd known the impact of what I was doing and going through had on other people. I wish that I knew that my mum, my dad were struggling to the extent, knowing that something was wrong, but that they felt helpless. But I think they didn't want to put that upon me because they didn't want to burden me with that. They were almost trying to protect me. And they thought, well, if we let him know that, he's only going to find things more difficult or feel even more responsibility. So both sides are kind of trying to protect each other a little bit. And I think one thing that we certainly need to get better at in society is normalizing conversations around it. But I think it's two ways. I think certainly we need to be better at talking about our own problems, and when things aren't going so well and how we're feeling. But I also think that the other thing that we need to get better at is checking in on each other. And this kind of culture of actually when somebody does sort of check in with you and check everything's okay, or ask twice if you like about these things, that it's not because it's a personal vendetta, but actually they're just worried about you and they want to help you. But people are very sensitive because they suddenly think, as soon as someone says, is everything okay, that, oh, well, that must mean that I'm portraying X, Y, or Z, but actually we just need to normalize that happening. And I think that's where both sides are really important, but there's such a fine line. It's such a difficult balance to get right. And a lot of it is down to the individual as well. But it's difficult, but the more we can kind of normalize both elements, I think the more people will have the confidence to reach out one way or the other.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree with that. I'm not sure if everyone on this call has seen the Roman Kemp documentary that was for Red Nose Day, the Silent Emergency, which was specifically looking at male suicide and male mental health. And through that, there was a group of young guys who'd lost their friend to suicide, and they'd come out with like the "Are you okay?" twice rule. So, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. No, are you actually okay? And then that's what can often prompt people into opening up. Is that some sort of approach or a similar type of approach that you both adhere to based on your own experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it helps. I think those words, "I'm fine," are things that I would say all the time. And usually "I'm fine" means I'm not. But I think for a long time, people didn't realize that, and I think now we've got a better understanding and awareness of that. So absolutely, I'd encourage people to do it. But it's as much kind of normalizing conversations around not feeling fine, and that actually it's okay to not be okay, or to be having a bad day, or for something to go wrong, just as it's okay for things to be brilliant and life to be treating you as you want it to. So I think as much as we can do about checking in, but also just normalizing those conversations about everything, and particularly, dare I say it, young men, about how we're feeling, and in a sporting environment, as Russell said, it's probably heightened to such a degree. I think that's getting better, and that kind of stigma is definitely diminishing, but there's still a way to go, I think, whether or not it's intentional, well, it's not, but I think there's still a way to go with that.
You've spoken there about stigmas, and in preparation for this interview, I was reading a piece that Russell, you'd done yourself, and you're mentioning about how in certain forms of the media, or the way that alcohol addiction in particular is portrayed, I think the words were, they're portrayed as just always doing bad things, and you know, you don't see anyone that after they've recovered, sort of thing. Do you think that the way that addictions are portrayed, and the way even like the terms that are used to talk about addiction, do you think that there's still work that needs to be done there to actually make people realize that, you know, it's not over dramatized and over sensationalized, it's just like people sort of go through this and be able to recognize it, and that actually they're not bad people, they're just people that are struggling?
Yeah, my kind of issue has always sort of been saying soaps, they're always, especially drinkers, are always seen as kind of park bench drinkers, or they're doing certain things, or in the papers you'll see someone maybe like Gazza at his worst, and that's the only side of it you see, and you don't, they never mention the struggle that's going on in between. And and I find it with myself as well, doing various bits where I look back on the paper stories of myself when I used to get into trouble, and they put in everything that I've done, but then that's all people see, even with, like, they don't see what was going on behind the scenes before that happened. And then you get comments on Facebook and social media. Even recently at work, we've moved into a new building. And some of the local people who live in the town where we're based were putting kind of disgusting stuff on social media about where our building's situated in the centre of town and the kinds of people that would be attending there. And it is, like, when I went to rehab, I was there with people my age, people in their 50s, 60s, ex-lawyers, sports stars, people who'd been in music. And it is just one of, it can get anyone at any point. Someone can go through their life drinking socially, and then something could happen to them, and it just takes over them. And you never know what's gone on in someone's life. You just need to scratch the surface and just be more aware of what's going on underneath someone's face, really.
Both of you obviously now work for organisations that obviously go a long way to helping people who are recovering and have gone through, like Russ says, some really tough times that often go on behind closed doors. Do you both want to just take us through a little bit about what your own individual organisations do in terms of helping people, but I suppose also maybe some of the common themes you've perhaps seen when people come to you asking for help?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the organisation I work for, Epic Risk Management, we're very much focused on the education and prevention side of things when it comes to gambling addiction. As an organization, we use lived experience. It's at the heart of everything that we do, and we use that to educate people, to try and stop people ever getting to the situation that we were. We recognize that when it came to gambling addiction particularly, there are a lot of organizations that dealt with people once they were at the edge of the cliff, for want of a better phrase, or once they had reached out for help. But actually, why don't we stop them trying to get there in the first place? There will always be people who get there, and that support and treatment being available is so important. But the more we can do to try and stop people getting there in the first place is kind of our mission. In terms of the work that I do, we work in kind of the high risk populations or demographics where the most harm exists, or people are potentially most vulnerable for various different reasons. And at least then people are entering into a relationship with it being able to make a more kind of informed choice or have a better understanding of the dangers, pitfalls, but actually also recognize signs in themselves and other people at when they might need to try and do something about it. So that's kind of in a nutshell, a snapshot of what we do. In terms of kind of the common themes that come out of it, Russell spoke really well there about the kind of stigma that's attached. And I think one of the issues when it comes to gambling, which is what my experience is that actually it's often the way that it's portrayed that, well, if you've gambled all your money away, you're just an idiot. Why did you do it? But it's not as simple as that. And I think that's what stops people reaching out for help, is the shame associated with it. People think, well, actually, if that's what people's opinion of me is going to be, then I don't want to tell people. But also it's a lack of belief and understanding that there is a way out. The financial damage that comes with a gambling addiction, as I've found out firsthand, is horrendous. But it doesn't mean life can't go on. It doesn't mean that you can't be happy, and that actually there is always a way out. And I think a lot of people don't ever believe that it's possible to stop, or recovery is possible, or life is possible without gambling. And actually, I think that's the most important message, is that it is. But what's stopping a lot of people is that they think either I don't want to tell anybody because I'm worried about what people would say or think, or the reaction, or I just simply don't think it's possible not to. But actually, as hopefully we're both testament to, that there is always hope and there is always a way out. It's not easy. I'd never pretend it is, but it's worth it.
At kind of Kaleidoscope, we're basically based in Wales. I work for the Powys sort of region. So we help people with kind of addiction problems, whether it's drug or alcohol. And we do sort of harm reduction. So we get people on kind of relapse prevention medication, whether it's kind of methadone or various things like that, or things to help with alcohol addiction. We work with other services, kind of like probation, criminal justice systems, with mental health teams. We work closely with them because usually, more often than not, if someone has an addiction problem, there is underlying kind of mental health problems. It's really tough for people, especially. A lot of people I find don't want to come into service with us because, like Patrick said, it's the shame, and you see quite a lot of drug snobbery. So if someone's a drinker, they don't want to come in because heroin addicts come to us sometimes. And it is that thing of just picking up the phone. Everyone's embarrassed about it. And since I've been working for Kaleidoscope, I've had a number of people call me personally rather than the office, because they'd rather just discuss it with me than coming into service, because they're worried about their jobs, what their employers will think, whether family friends will find out. It's quite hard for me, knowing what I've gained through stopping drinking, to kind of put that onto other people that it's not bad to talk about it. And you can gain stuff. Like I don't struggle now with alcohol, but there's things like I had my wedding where I was toasting with sparkling elderflower, and your stag do. We went on a sober stag do, which is quite weird. And it's times like those that I really appreciate kind of my sobriety. Because we all went on my stag do and we just had a good time in each other's company. And there isn't a distraction of being drunk, as there's someone who's causing more trouble than the other. And that all started through me just accepting the help. All the things I have now in my life, from that one kind of bedroom flat, sleeping on the sofa with various bottles on the floor, is all all stemmed from just accepting that help that one time. If other people just, if we can help one person just by them picking up the phone and just accepting the help, then it makes our job worth it, I think.
You mentioned there also about people calling you because you know they felt as though they could trust you and they were maybe a bit too embarrassed to do it through other ways. What, how do you help those people to start opening up to those around them to sort of overcome that embarrassment? How does, or is that individual for each different person?
I think it's individual. A lot of people find it difficult. I've got quite a dark sense of humour. So my family will just take the mick out of me with drinking. So I find it really easy with my family. But I think people reach out to me and I just kind of tell them that it's nothing to be worried about and just kind of tell them my story, what I've gained from it, kind of what I lost through doing it. And I just try to kind of make them feel comfortable that it's not such a bad thing. It's just something that people go through. People go through kind of mental breakdowns, things like that. Addiction is just another kind of part of life that happens to some people. And it's nothing to ever be embarrassed about. And that's why I do things like this. I'll speak when people ask me to about it. And I see it as a good thing. I could live now without doing anything that causes me any harm. So, yeah, I see it as a good thing for me.
Off the back of that, and this is kind of for both of you as well, as tough as those experiences were, do you feel like you've become better people out of it and that it's essentially made you into who you are now?
I mean, in my experience, absolutely. I wouldn't wish what happened to me or what I went through on my worst enemy. I really wouldn't. I wish it hadn't happened to me. But actually, part of the biggest step for me was accepting it, taking ownership of it. And actually, once I'd done that, I now know that one thing is that I'm much stronger for it. But also I'm a much better person. Everything I was when I was gambling, I try not to be now. It's simple as that. And I look back on that time and realize now what I was like. But I realize that actually, whilst I don't make excuses for my behavior, that was what the addiction did to me. But I've learned so much from it about me, but also about other people. That yeah, it's definitely made me better for it, and in many ways I'm kind of grateful for that, and I have to remind myself of that all the time when I start to feel sorry for myself. But yeah, it's one of those things, because you don't want to say yeah I'm better for it and then people think well maybe I should go through it, because I wouldn't wish it upon anyone. But certainly that's one of the positives I take from it, and the other thing really is that whilst it will always be part of me, I hope it doesn't kind of define me. And one of the big things in life now is I don't want to be remembered as sort of Patrick Foster, the gambling addict. I'd much rather be remembered for kind of what I do in my recovery, and life after gambling. And hopefully I can do that, because I think that's one of the big things, is if you let it define you, if you spend your whole life wondering kind of what if and if only, life won't get any better.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think it's definitely, it's made me into a better son, better father, better husband, better brother, and they're the main things that I never was when I was drinking. And as long as I can be those things, that's good enough for me, really. Because yeah, all the years I wasted being that person that they just wanted me to be and I wanted to be. But yeah, I'm quite happy with the way things have gone for me. And it's not, a lot of people kind of think once you get things sorted, life's just rosy then. But there's things, it's hard work every day. And like this year, for example, I've lost my best friend and my dad in the space of kind of 3 weeks of each other. And they used to be old excuses for me to go and drink on. But now it helps me because I can be there for my family when they need me, or I can be there for my friends' parents when they need me, which I was never that person. I was always a selfish person. Now I love helping other people. And yeah, it's much better life being sober anyway. And I've got, because Patrick plays cricket, I remember once, this has nothing to do with anything, but I thought I'd just say, but I once got asked to play a cricket match, and I kind of said, yeah, this is when I was drinking, and I turned up with just boxer shorts on, and they gave me the cup, and I actually hit a ball, went to run, and this cup just slid all the way down my leg, out the bottom of my trousers, and is left in the middle of the pitch. And yeah, it's very embarrassing. I just remembered that story then. Sorry, went off on one. Funny times.
We're all alright with some tangents on this show. We've had plenty of them in the past. Trust me.
Yeah.
Kind of looking at sort of society, I suppose, at the moment, and COVID obviously has ruled our lives somewhat in the last year and a half. And people so often go on about the hidden pandemic behind the actual pandemic, alluding to mental health and sort of what's been happening behind the scenes since we've all been locked in our homes for quite some time. Is that something that you both see at the moment? And is that essentially maybe a crisis, if it's fair to call it that, once we are out of the COVID crisis itself? And that's something we have to come to terms with and be prepared to help those people who will probably need it.
I think from my perspective, there's kind of two parts to this. I think the first is that I don't think there's any doubt that the effects of what's happened are going to be felt in this way. And I think we may not see the effects for a little bit of time, but I think they're certainly going to be evident. I don't think anybody has not found what we've been through in the last 18 months difficult, whoever they are, whether they've kind of got pre-existing sort of issues or struggles or ones that have materialized through it. And I do think that it needs to be a real focus because of that. But I do think that during this time, what's one of the kind of positive outcomes is that I do think people have been much more aware of each other's kind of mental health and well-being and how important it is and the focus that needs to be. I just hope it's not something that, oh, well, we were dealing with a global pandemic and therefore we all need to worry or think about and talk about our kind of mental health and well-being during this time. We actually need to keep that kind of momentum going. When it comes to some of the issues that I deal with, if you like, on a daily basis with regards to gambling and the convergence between online gaming and gambling, I have huge concerns about the impact of the pandemic. And part of that is through no one's fault, really, in that they weren't able to do a lot of other things, but people had access to that. People were spending more time on their screens online, and what comes with that is more people doing it, and I do think that became normal, and some of these activities became normalized during that time because of the accessibility, the exposure that people had, and the ease at which they could do it. And I have huge concerns about the next generation with regards to these issues on the back of the pandemic. But as I said, I don't think we're gonna see the effects in reality for a little bit until after we've come out of it, and I am worried. So I think we've got to take the positives from what's come, in that there seems to have been more awareness and focus on it, but also we need to use that to our advantage in understanding that there is going to be an awful lot of people that have found this very difficult, and that, for want of a better phrase, there's going to be a serious hangover, I think.
Yeah, I agree again. It's especially where we are in Powys, it's kind of, it's very remote. A lot of our clients live remotely, and there's no public transport. Obviously, everyone's been not able to travel, and there's a lot of loneliness. And we've kind of noticed that our referrals kind of going up as we're coming out of lockdown, because people have been in lockdown, they've been drinking more than they probably should have, or doing things they probably shouldn't have. And it's a hard one, because people have been lonely, but it has also been one of the best times where people do check on each other more now. And I just hope that kind of continues once we get out of this, whenever it does end, where people are concerned for each other. But yeah, I think we're going to see a bit of a spike in referrals as people go back to work or things start to level out, because it's been hard. Like, with our clients, we've had to work from home all through the pandemic, and not having one-to-one kind of face-to-face meetings with people. You can ask someone on the phone how you're doing, how you're feeling, and unless you can see them in person, you can't tell their body language. Anyone can say, yeah, I'm okay, but unless you see them, you don't know. And it's been really difficult to work with people through the pandemic. And yeah, we're slowly getting back to normal working now, and hopefully we can start to help people properly and give them the sort of service they need, really.
Another thing I've noticed in the pandemic is you're spending more time at home, so therefore you're spending more time on your screens. A lot of us is because there's not a lot else to do, and a lot of then when you're on those screens, there are a lot of things that you see gambling adverts, you'll see adverts for alcohol, and you've got so many, especially in sports as well, you've got so many sponsorships where it's so you've either got like a major beer brand sponsoring a massive competition, or you've got, you know, a betting firm supporting football teams. Do you think that that's something that needs to be addressed and regulated, because even if, you know, they're not directly putting those things in front of people, it's still being advertised, it's still putting the thought in people's minds, and because we've got more screen time, we've got more time to sort of take a look and think, oh, that advert looked good, let's have a look at that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think something needs to be done about it. There's currently a review going on with regards to gambling specifically, looking into things like the regulation of adverts and sponsorship, because I think we've reached saturation point now. I don't think anybody would deny that there's too many of these adverts. It's everywhere you look, you can't get away from it. And what I have a fundamental issue with is the exposure that young people are getting to it. And that temptation or reminder is always there. And that some of them can sort of trying to entice people into engaging with the activity. I'm not stupid enough to think that there's not an awful lot of people that do it as a form of entertainment and for the right reasons. And not everybody was in the situation that I'm in, but the more people that are doing it, the more people that are going to get harmed by it. And if people want to do it, they'll do it. They don't need the constant reminders. And actually, as somebody who has been through it, I find it difficult. I don't now have the same urges and temptations to go and do it, but it is a constant reminder that I don't need or appreciate, especially when it's sort of so relentless in its nature. But I think that's certainly something that needs to be looked into, will be, and hopefully the right kind of changes and level of changes are made. Otherwise, I don't see the problem getting any better.
Yeah, and I think from my point of view, when I was drinking, the biggest problem kind of I found was when I go into supermarkets and things like that. The first, as soon as you walk through a door of a supermarket, there's a big pyramid of kind of lager or whatever on sale. Or as soon as you go to the counter in a smaller shop, all the alcohol's behind the counter and it just looks at you and stares at you. And I think for someone in early recovery, it really makes them struggle having to walk past it every time they want to go get a loaf of bread or something. I never really struggled with kind of adverts on TV because it wasn't physically there in front of me. But yeah, the supermarkets and things like that, I always used to find really hard because you walk past a big crate of beer, and especially on days like today where it's really sunny out. And yeah, I used to find supermarkets really difficult, and the way they kind of set things up in there, it's very kind of alcohol based.
That's a really good point, actually, because I suppose that consumerism, isn't it? It kind of takes over a lot of thinking a lot of the time when, like you say, there could be people who do struggle, and you've got that sort of in front of you going in and out. I think is a really good point. And Patrick, you mentioned sort of the impact it could have on young people as well. Does there need to be more education at a younger level? Because I suppose at the moment it probably differs from school to school, but whether there needs to be a renewed emphasis on perhaps giving young people the tools to, and the knowledge, I suppose, to be able to cope with things like that if they do face it in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, education is a key to prevention. There certainly needs to be more of it. There's been some real positive changes with regards to gambling, the inclusion in it, in kind of PSHE type curriculums and things, and more schools not ignoring it as an issue. I certainly think that still more can be done. I'd like to see kind of more funding for education with regards to things like this that comes from the government itself. But it's also a kind of awareness that actually through the accessibility, exposure, etc., that more and more young people are engaging in these activities, and we need to try and reach them before they start. I think the other thing that is huge, and Russell mentioned it earlier, that sort of addiction, a lot of people see addiction in isolation, but actually it is just a kind of mental health issue. And the two are kind of obviously intrinsically linked. I think educating young people around mental health and well-being from a young age, and I mean that from a really young age, it doesn't have to be kind of terrifying or worrying, but actually ingraining that in culture is so important. I think previously, I certainly look back at my time, although I was very fortunate in my education, nobody ever really talked to me about mental health and well-being, and yet it's really the most important thing. So it has to be prioritized in education, and parents have got a big part to play in that, but so does the education system, I think. Because what better tool is there really to equip young people than that? I'm not sure.
On that point, some people may say that educating children at a young age about serious issues like this can, you know, sort of scare them and can, you know, can be quite difficult. But I guess if you're just talking about just starting to just make them generally aware of things that, you know, issues, or even just aware to ask people how they are, is that sort of what you're suggesting there, Patrick?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd never suggest that Russell or I go in and talk to young kids about gambling or alcohol, because that could sort of increase curiosity and that sort of thing. But I think very much, as you said, some of these key messages around kind of vulnerability, what it means to be kind of strong, the fact that mental health needs to be viewed in the same way that physical health is. Why do you, when you're young, get taught about how it's important to eat things that are healthy because it's important for your physical health? And actually, we need to start viewing mental health in the same way. I certainly look back on my experiences, and I completely neglected my mental health because I thought, well, I'll only deal with it when something goes wrong with it. But we've all got it. It doesn't need to carry the negative connotations that I think it always has. So, yeah, I think obviously in the right way, just kind of embedding and ingraining these kind of messages around prioritizing it, looking after it, learning about it is massive. And as they sort of get older and enter into adulthood, that's the time to start addressing individual issues like addiction, whether it's gambling, drugs, alcohol, and other more specific kind of elements of mental health.
And well, I've name dropped the Roman Kemp documentary once already. But on that note, there was part of that episode where they did go into a primary school who were taking it upon themselves to do that mental health education with their kids. And it's just kind of ranged from, you know, a child just explaining what depression was to them and something like that. And I think it can really, really make a big difference.
You're listening to Sportspiel's Mental Health Awareness Week podcast specials. Go to our website or follow us on social media to catch all 5 episodes throughout the week and help raise awareness using the hashtag Mental Health Awareness Week. You can find all those links and resources in the show notes of this podcast episode.
For parents, family, friends perhaps as well, of someone who could be in a difficult position or someone who could be struggling. And we've often talked about how they can be put in a difficult position themselves, not knowing how to tackle it and not knowing how to talk about it. Is there any advice you both would give to someone in that position on how they could approach that very sensitive issue and often a taboo topic in a way that can actually benefit the person who is struggling? If you've got any advice from your own experiences.
I think in my experience, the key is addressing it, not thinking, oh, well, this is going to be a difficult conversation to have, therefore I'm not going to have it. I think do something about it. I think act on your instinct, because your instinct is often right. But I also think there's a way of going about it. One of the things that people fear most is judgment. And actually, if you can talk to people in a way that means that actually, ultimately, all you've ever got is their best interests at heart, and that you're just wanting to kind of help them and make sure they're okay. I think that's the most important thing, because people are very fearful of being judged. And if you can try and remove that, I think that really helps. I think the other thing is often people think that they need to be a kind of hero and solve the problem completely. And actually, I think sometimes just saying to someone, I don't understand how you're feeling or what you're going through, but what I am going to do is I'm going to listen and be there for you. And that actually it might be that somebody talks to you and you say, well, I'm going to get you some help because there is help available. But I think often sometimes people think, oh, well, I need to deal with this situation here and there. And you can say something that actually is detrimental. So don't always think you've got to solve the problem, because it's not that easy to solve. But actually just be there and listen. And if you can, that's as we've both alluded to, sometimes half the battle. If you can just put someone in a position where they feel comfortable to open up, you're a long way there. So that would be my advice, really.
Yeah, I'd probably say the same thing. Like, a few times my family tried to intervene, but it was very much gung-ho. We're going to, right, just stop this, kind of telling me about my behaviour, why my behaviour is bad. And all it did was kind of push me the opposite direction. So I didn't want to be told what I was doing was bad. And it is just funny. If they'd have kind of looking back, if you just sit down and you're just inquisitive about how someone's feeling, why they're feeling like that, then it's a lot easier for them to open up to you than if you push them away. Because the one thing that I find a lot is the addiction is the thing that's closest to the person. It's the one, it's kind of their comfort blanket whilst they're doing it. And if you go in there too quick and just try to take it away from them, then they're obviously going to run in the opposite direction. So it's about doing everything slowly and just showing people that you care, and that's your main intentions, is just to help them. And I think that's probably the best approach, really.
Then sort of my kind of final topic to finish off on, and Mental Health Awareness Week this year is based around nature and connecting with nature. How has that helped the two of you? I suppose, again, we're alluding to the pandemic a little bit here and how helpful it has been, certainly from my own perspective anyway, in just getting to have that time outside, or back in, say, the early days of lockdown one, when we were allowed that time outside to exercise, and how beneficial that was. But yeah, in terms of your own experiences and how nature has helped you, I'm not sure if there's a way that you can relate to that, or if there's something you've experienced yourself. I'll start with Russ for that one.
Yeah, so me and my wife have always kind of were National Trust members, which is, I keep that on the down low when I tell people I'm a boxer. But yeah, we've always enjoyed kind of walking. It's always been something we've done. And yeah, that's the one good thing I think that's come out of this lockdown, is seeing how many families, like our local park before lockdown was always dead. And then now you go out and there's families just kicking a ball around, taking dogs for a walk with each other, rather than just one parent taking a dog out. And at work, well, yesterday was off, we started a walking group at work, just so kind of service users can come and meet people who are kind of the same kind of mindset as them. We just get out, I think, a lot of the time, if people are in a kind of within four walls, they close up and they'll only say what they want to say. Whereas if you get someone out in nature and just walk and talk with them, they tend to be a lot more open about things and probably say things they don't mean to say and then write it down. But yeah, no, it's one of those, it's really good to get people out. And it's just a bit of air in people's lungs, I find has been amazing since lockdown anyway, and seeing family members come together.
Yeah, for me, exercise has played a massive part in kind of my recovery generally, but also as a coping mechanism in the last 18 months during the pandemic. I sort of developed rather my addictive personality certainly manifests itself now with regards to running, and I've become a bit obsessed with it. But actually, it's so good for me, both physically and mentally, and just being outside, the fresh air. Now I'm a bit fitter than I was. I enjoy it. But part of it is just being outside. And people talk a lot about kind of mindfulness and finding it in different ways. And it can be quite an intimidating word, I think. But for me, when I'm running, my brain operates at kind of 100 miles an hour. And it's the one thing that I do where actually I spend however long I do it and I don't really think about too much. And that for me is massive. It's so nice. But there's something about being outside and doing it outside. Obviously, it's nicer when the sun's shining and it's warm. But even actually during the winter, I found it really refreshing in different ways. So I always encourage people, if they can, to try and get outside. And I know a lot of people love going to the gym and doing exercise is so important. I wouldn't discourage them from doing it. But actually, if you can get outside and amongst nature, it's kind of even more powerful and effective. So, yeah, it definitely resonates with me.
I can definitely resonate with that with myself. Running has definitely been a little bit of a release throughout, particularly the winter months, and just being able to get outside for a little bit. And even we had a little challenge at work, the 3 mile challenge, where we all got into our teams and see who could run the most miles each week. Got very competitive at times, but Definitely well worth it. I couldn't let this opportunity pass by without mentioning that Patrick is quite literally putting his body on the line and is doing the London Marathon for charity as well. So how is that going? I suppose that plays a big part in the running training at the moment too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you both know, I'm an ambassador for the Mintridge Foundation, and something that I'm really passionate about because I love everything that the charity stands for. It's been such a difficult time for everybody, but charities in particular. And I thought to myself, I've had a lifelong ambition to run the London Marathon more so than anything else, and no better time to do it really than now, and just to raise as much money as I can for that organization. So yeah, the training is very sort of gung-ho. There's not much method in the madness. It's kind of just get up and go. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, as I say, if I can raise any money, then it will be worth it. But yeah, if anyone can support what is an incredible organization, I'd be incredibly grateful. So thank you for mentioning it.
Definitely. Well, we agree with that. And as everyone who listens to this podcast knows, we've been linked with Mintridge for a good long while now. And it feels so long ago when we were actually in the same room together. Seeing people face to face, my word, what on earth was that like? And likewise, having done a half marathon myself for Mintridge, it is well worth it. And I know Alex is pushing me to do another one. So that may come in the future. Thank you both for sharing and taking part in this episode. I think that's an incredibly open conversation. And I always say it's incredibly brave to open up about things like this, because like you both said, it is personal. It does look back on sort of darker periods in your life. But like you said, I think the way you've both come out of it is a true inspiration to a lot of people, and a credit to yourselves. And it also, like you say, putting what your experiences back into helping others who are going through a similar thing, I think is hugely admirable. So thank you both for taking part in this particular episode. Before I round this off, a reminder that Mental Health Awareness Week is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. So you can go to mentalhealth.org.uk to find out more helpful information if you do need it, some helpful advice likewise if you do need it, and as both Patrick and Russ have said, there is lots of help out there, so you can find some information out there. But likewise, the two charities we mentioned today, Epic Risk Management and Kaleidoscope, also do some fantastic work at the same time. So ultimately, spread the word, spread the awareness. As has often been said, talking about it can make a massive difference. So we really do hope this has made a difference to someone listening, and in continuing to spread that awareness, because it is needed. That's it then for this particular episode. Take care, everyone. Those who are listening, better days are ahead, I'm sure. But until our next episode, look after yourselves, and goodbye.